Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and you're listening to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. Welcome. My aim is to bring you down-to-earth, conversational episodes that help you develop a deeper understanding of how your body's changing in your 40s, and most importantly, how you can support yourself throughout this wonderful transitional phase of your life. Join me for my solo episodes and also episodes with guests for fun, fresh, truthful chat on all things health and happiness in your 40s. And now on to the episode. Hi, and welcome back to another episode with me, your host, Francesca. In today's episode, we're going to go into progesterone again and again. I think it's really important to continue to hear the same sort of information, message, over and over again, especially as we're moving through something that is a phase in life that can be quite daunting, frustrating, and confusing for so many of us. And I think the more we hear something being explained, the more we can really start to understand it. I think sometimes we hear things once and it just doesn't quite hit in the same way as it might when you hear it explained again. So I really think it's an important area of perimenopause to understand. So progesterone is usually the first of our two main ovarian hormones to start shifting, essentially start declining as we move from our late 30s into our 40s. And for a lot of women, it's the hormone that explains so many of the changes that they begin to notice at that time, late 30s and early 40s. Things like anxiety that feels new or unexplained, changes in sleep, feeling less resilient to stress, periods much heavier, maybe they're clotting, maybe you're flooding, and all of this is new or worse. This is a really important part of perimenopause physiology to understand, not just so that, you know, you feel worried or overwhelmed about what's going on, but so that things can start to make sense. And actually, we can take that worry and overwhelm away because we understand what's going on, and then also understand what we can do to support ourselves, which is what we'll be talking about. Because when you understand what's happening, then you can work with your body rather than feeling at odds with it, which is a really common feeling for women to start experiencing in perimenopause. I hear it all the time. I see it all the time on social media, on Instagram, loads of dread coming with the typical perimenopause joke reels. You know, while some of it's funny and it's great to relate to each other with these different experiences, but a lot of it can just leave us feeling at odds with our bodies and with perimenopause. So in this episode, I'm going to explain why progesterone is so important, what it actually does in the body, how and when we make it, why it starts to decline in perimenopause, and how we can gently support it. So let's look at what progesterone is. What does it do? So progesterone is one of the two main female sex hormones made by your ovaries. So you've got estrogen and progesterone. Unlike estrogen, which is made every single day of your menstrual cycle, your cycling days, every day, progesterone is only made after ovulation. So you make it once a month and it sticks around for roughly the entirety of the second half of your cycle. So roughly around 2 weeks if you had an average 28-day cycle. Progesterone is what's known as a steroid hormone, meaning that it's made from cholesterol. So a clue there is that we do need to be eating quality cholesterol to help us make it. It's a raw material for it. So it's made from cholesterol and it acts as a chemical messenger, which travels through the bloodstream and it delivers instructions to different tissues and organs around your body. And this is really important. We have progesterone receptors all over the body, not just in, you know, the reproductive system. And that's why progesterone affects so much more than periods or fertility. So, of course, we know about progesterone being important for us to hold a pregnancy and nourish a pregnancy and take it to full term. And we know that progesterone is important for thinning out or balancing out the lining of the uterus so that when we're not allowing it to continue to build up and up and up, and that when we have our period, it can start to healthily thin out our period so it's not too thick. So let's say if you may or may not already have known that, but those are the two sort of main things that we would know about progesterone. But it actually affects so much more than those two things. So one of the biggest areas of progesterone is that it influences the brain and the nervous system. It has what we call neuroprotective effects. So neuro being brain. So brain protective effects. It supports myelination, which is the protective coating around your nerve cells. I liken the nerve cells to sort of the pipe, and the myelin sheath, myelination of that pipe, is the insulative layer that would go around a pipe, like in a loft, for example. So progesterone supports that layer, which is really important for example, preventing, you know, brain degenerative or body degenerative, nerve degenerative diseases later in life, for example, which cause that myelination to thin or fray, if you like. And progesterone plays, because of that, it plays a huge role in mood, cognition, focus, memory, learning. And that's why that when progesterone starts to decline, so this could be late, even mid to late 30s, early 40s, a lot of women will start to notice mood swings or changes in mood, anxiety, new or worse irritability, brain fog, sleep issues, or that they simply just don't feel like themselves anymore. And that was my story, early 40s, around 41, I started to notice anxiety and some sleep issues. And for me, I knew at that point it was a decline in progesterone situation for me. Progesterone can also be converted into a powerful brain hormone that's called allopregnanolone. And this allopregnanolone increases the action of GABA, which is your calming, anti-anxiety, sleep-supportive brain chemical, neurotransmitter. So if progesterone is low, the nervous system can become more reactive. And that's why we might start to feel less resilient to stress, less able to cope with stress, feeling more wired but tired, difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep, because we're in this more heightened state when we have this lower level of progesterone. The nervous system just isn't getting the same sort of robust, calming anti-anxiety effects as it was before. And this is really important to say out loud to yourself. Perimenopause isn't you failing to cope, or these, whether it's perimenopause related or not, these sort of symptoms, feeling less able to cope, feeling less resilient, difficulties staying asleep or getting to sleep. That's not you failing to cope. It's your physiology, because progesterone also helps to regulate that stress response. It helps to reduce us out of that, pull us out of that fight flight stress response. And so lower levels can allow cortisol to rise more easily and put us into this fight flight stress response state. Over time, that can also start to affect blood sugar regulation, energy, mood, thyroid health, overall resilience, and other things, sleep as well. Progesterone is also anti-inflammatory for the body. It supports, as I said, thyroid function. It's helpful for fluid balance, so therefore it can help to reduce that puffiness, water retention we might experience around ankles, fingers, wrists, around our period. And it's supportive of immune health. So while it's often talked about purely as a fertility hormone, your brain and your body rely on progesterone for your day-to-day sense of well-being. So estrogen and progesterone are designed to work together across the menstrual cycle. So we have estrogen, like I said, made throughout the cycle every day, gradually rises just after your period starts to finish. And it's what we call proliferative hormone. So proliferative meaning that it builds things up, including the uterine lining. So it causes a thickening of the uterine lining, which is good in the first half of your cycle. But once we then ovulate, progesterone takes over, it should take over as long as we've ovulated and therefore made it. Progesterone takes over, and its job is to transform that thickened lining into a softer, more nourishing, stable environment by increasing blood supply and glandular sort of secretions from different glands. And that's what then helps us to have a better period, less heavy, less painful. And this balance is what we call this opposed estrogen versus unopposed estrogen. So unopposed estrogen is when we have estrogen all through the cycle, like I said, but then we didn't ovulate, so we didn't make progesterone. And now that whole cycle is it's unopposed. It's estrogen all through the cycle, not being opposed by its partner hormone. Some people also call this estrogen dominance. I've referred to it as that in the past and still do sometimes, which basically means that estrogen was allowed then to dominate the entire cycle because it wasn't met by its partner hormone, progesterone. It wasn't balanced out. So the correct sort of technical term for it is unopposed estrogen. But what we want is opposed estrogen. So when progesterone comes along in the second half of the cycle, it prevents excessive thickening of the uterine lining. It helps then to keep your periods lighter and less painful. And it also reduces PMS generally, including, you know, headaches, mood issues, bloating, breast tenderness, breast pain, even migraines. Progesterone really is the yin to estrogen's yang. It's calming, it's protective, it's grounding. So estrogen isn't a bad thing, yin and yang, we need both of them, but we just need to calm estrogen after a while within the cycle. You know, that partner hormone needs to come along and say, look, it's like the friend, I've said this before, but you might have heard me say it before. If you're out with a friend, you know, and she's like the life and soul of the party and she's dancing on the tables and she's like commanding all this attention and she's great, but there'll always be a part, you know, a time in the night where you're like, come on, you just want to get her down off the table, take her hand, pull her down, get her to sit down and chill for a bit. And then something else might take over for the crowd that's a little bit more calming. So that's what progesterone is to estrogen. So when ovulation doesn't happen, progesterone isn't made. And then estrogen is left unopposed, unbalanced out by its partner hormone. This is when a lot of the symptoms of what we would also refer to as estrogen dominance or unopposed estrogen show up. And that becomes increasingly common in progesterone, in perimenopause. Sorry, I'm getting the two P words mixed up. So unopposed estrogen dominance becomes increasingly more of a thing as we move through perimenopause, particularly from early 40s onwards, because we're just not making as much progesterone every month as we were before. Or there's some months that we're not making it at all. And that's because, as I said, progesterone is only made if you ovulate. After ovulation, a temporary gland called the corpus luteum forms, and its entire job is to produce progesterone for around 11 to 14 days. So that's essentially the luteal phase of the cycle, the second half of your cycle. The first half is called the follicular phase, the second half is the luteal phase, and that is how long progesterone would last. Sometimes ovulation happens, but the corpus luteum isn't formed as robustly as it once was. So the progesterone is made, but just not in the same optimal amounts that it was being made before when you had a more robust corpus luteum. And then, of course, like I said, sometimes ovulation doesn't happen at all. No ovulation means no progesterone at all. This is also why hormonal contraception, so the pill, the implant, the injection, doesn't provide natural progesterone. The progestins, so a lot of doctors will talk, they'll use the same term, progesterone and progestins, interchangeably, but they're not the same thing. Progesterone refers to the natural progesterone that we make in the ovaries as a result of ovulation, and progestins that are used in hormonal contraception, oral contraception, the depot injection, for example, or coils, they're not the same. Then it's not a molecular, you know, structurally, molecularly, it's not the same in structure. And progestins don't have the same calming brain supportive benefits. They do have the same benefits on the lining of the uterus. So they protect that lining from the, like I said, those proliferative effects of estrogen. So that's great and very important when we think about uterine cancers, for example, but it isn't going to have the same calming brain support, sleep, anti-anxiety effects that we've talked about within the rest of the body. Just doesn't work in the same way. So also, I said that real progesterone, the word progesterone only refers to what we make naturally in our body, but the word progesterone also refers to body identical forms of progesterone therapy. So for example, in the UK, there's a brand called Utrogestan. I'm currently using body identical progesterone myself at 46, and I can't remember the brand now because I always take it out of the packet. But that is body identical progesterone, basically means it's been made in exactly the same molecular structure as the real thing. So when it comes into our body, it does have the same benefits as the real thing. But progestins that we find in, as I said, hormonal contraception, it just isn't the same thing. Just to make that clear distinction. So one simple way to know or to sort of check if you're ovulating is to track your basal body temperature each morning. So I was doing this for many years. I started around 40. I only stopped doing it about a year, well, not even a year ago now. But it was really, really helpful for me. In the first 5 years of my 40s, it was a game changer for me to really be tracking whether I, you know, really giving myself that indication as to whether I was ovulating each month. And I could really start to see the links. I didn't have many months where I didn't think I was ovulating based on my basal body temperature, which I'll explain how that works in a minute. But for the handful of times I didn't get the indication that I'd ovulated, I knew that by way of symptoms. So I really was feeling it. I thought, right, it's funny. It's so interesting to see that link so clearly. So basically, progesterone raises our body temperature very slightly. So after ovulation, if you're tracking your body temperature every morning before you even get out of bed, you put a digital thermometer in your mouth, you'll see a small raise in body temperature, but it will be sustained. So if you've ovulated, you'll have, let's say you ovulate on Tuesday and then you wake up on Wednesday morning and you take your temperature and you've been taking it every day up until that point, you will see this very slight increase in your temperature, usually around 0.1 to 0.3 degrees Celsius. I'm not sure what that is in Fahrenheit. But that rise will be sustained throughout the rest of your cycle until you come on your next period. Because your period is then triggered by the drop in progesterone, which basically also means a drop in that slight increase of temperature. So you're looking for a very slight temperature increase around ovulation that's sustained right up until your next period. A few months of tracking can be so informative. It's really powerful. So like I said, I'm 46. I still ovulate I haven't been doing basal body temperature tracking now for about 9 months. But while I was tracking my temperature daily, I could clearly see that rise every single month. The few months that I didn't ovulate because I didn't see that rise, so I thought, right, well, I've not ovulated, it always coincided with unusually stressful situations or a significant emotional load. You know, for example, I lost my dad a couple of years ago, and then the next cycle, when it came to ovulation, there was no temperature increase at all. And so I thought, well, you know, it's no surprise that I haven't managed to ovulate this month, because one of the biggest blockers to ovulation is stress, emotional stress, physical stress, mental stress. So I was not surprised that I didn't that month. And if I've had the odd months where things were particularly busy with work or with other things, and I just didn't have as much space in my life and things were just feeling really, really stressful, again, that might have happened. So it was really clear for me to see that every month. This is just a really clear example of how sensitive ovulation is and how responsive it can be to support as well. So it's very sensitive to, like I said, this really stressful month, but it can also be very sensitive in the opposite way as well. The things that we can put in place to support it are really helpful. So perimenopause is essentially a change in communication between the brain and the ovaries, which is why we start to ovulate less. This signals from the brain to the ovaries to tell them to ovulate, for example, become quieter. They become less consistent. They become less on time. So therefore, ovulation starts to become harder to achieve reliably. And or if we do it, like I said, that formation of that temporary gland, the corpus luteum, isn't as robust as it was before, and therefore we don't get as much progesterone. But it isn't all or nothing. With the right nutrition, the right lifestyle habits, nervous system support, so many women can ovulate far more often than they would have done otherwise. So when I was spending all those years tracking my temperature, the handful of times that I didn't ovulate because of big things that had happened, I know that had I not been actively doing things to nutritionally, lifestyle-wise, nervous system-wise to support my body to ovulate, there would have been far more months that I didn't ovulate, not just the ones where, for example, my dad died or, you know, something really unusual happened. It would have happened on many what I would call normal months as well. So I know that there is so much that women can be doing to support themselves, and it would have, you know, they'll get a big bang for their buck, basically. And I see that with all my clients, you know, that once they start making some really simple changes, even just one change at a time, they are ovulating more months than they would have had they not sort of intervened. So this is where we can make a real difference to our entire experience of perimenopause. If we can help our bodies to make a hormone more often than it would have done had we not tried for more years of our perimenopause, then we're going to have a much better experience of perimenopause. So I just turned 46 a month ago, and about 5 months ago, I just knew that I was at a point where I am probably still managing to ovulate more often than I would have done if I wasn't doing the things I do. But I don't feel that I just know it's not as robust as it was before. I'm moving further through perimenopause. I went through a very stressful period, particularly last year, and I thought, I need help at this point. So I just want a little bit of support from the body identical progesterone therapy. So I chose with my doctor to add that in about 4 or 5 months ago. And that's been really helpful. So I take progesterone in the second half of my cycle around when I would or do ovulate. And it just helps to either top up the small amount of progesterone that I have managed to make, and or it puts that progesterone in that I maybe didn't make. But, you know, all I know is it's really been helpful. But like I say, for the first 5 or 6 years before I went there, I didn't need to do that because I was managing to support my body so well. And I'm still supporting my body in the same way. But it's just that things changed for me a little bit last year. I'm now further along in the perimenopause journey. And I just personally found that that would be something that was going to be helpful for me. I also have lots of friends, lots of clients who are my age or a bit older, and they're not needing to go there just yet with the body identical progesterone. They're still, you know, feeling fine. We're all so different. We cannot compare each other to one another. Like, you know, just because if you have a friend who or a colleague who's a certain age and they're already taking using hormonal therapy, or vice versa, you have a friend who's the same age or older and they're not, don't compare yourself to those people. We're all uniquely different. And, you know, what works for one doesn't necessarily work for everybody on that front. So I just wanted to be open and transparent about my own experience with this and what I'm doing in case it helps anybody. So moving back to low progesterone, so looking at some common signs that yours might be low. Now, you might notice these some months, random months, many months, or all months. But this would be, you know, if you're noticing it all months, then potentially you're not, you know, maybe you're not ovulating any months, or maybe you are, but it's just a really low amount of progesterone. Maybe there's other things going on, because obviously these symptoms I'm going to talk about now can mimic other things as well. Might not always just be down to low progesterone. They can also be down to circumstances, lifestyle. But if you're noticing, because a lot of people will say to me, oh, I actually notice these things some months, but not all months, you know, or I've had a really good month this month. I haven't had the heavy periods. I haven't had the anxiety. And it could be that you managed to robustly ovulate that month. But what's happening in perimenopause is that it's all so unpredictable. So we don't just suddenly get to a point where we're not going to be able to ovulate very well anymore ever. We get to a point where it's all just so unpredictable. 1 month or 6 months could, or, you know, 4 months could be not great, not a robust level of progesterone made. And then you could have a month where it's just great. And, you know, everything was just wonderful for the month in terms of your brain to ovary communication and how much progesterone was made. And then again, it could all just not work out that way again the next month. So common signs of low progesterone, some or many months, include difficulty sleeping, especially in the second half of your cycle. So a big clue that it's down to progesterone as to why you can't sleep is that it's occurring only in the second half of your cycle, and particularly towards the end when you're getting closer to your period coming. Anxiety or inner restlessness. So again, particularly in the second half of your cycle, heavier or more painful periods, maybe with flooding, clotting, gushing, you know, and this being a new thing, breast tenderness, breast pain, particularly, like I said, in the second half of the cycle, headaches or migraines leading up to your period, spotting in the luteal phase. So, you know, anywhere to maybe any of the 2 weeks before your period is due, you might notice some brown spotting or even red spotting. That's a bit of a sign, but particularly when it's darker. shorter cycles. So cycles starting to get shorter. So mine a couple of years ago started, they gradually went from 28 days down to 27. It took about a year for that. Then it took another couple of years for them to go down to 26 days. And it took another year for them to go down to 25 days. Now mine and 24. And now mine are starting to space out again. But shorter cycles is a sign of low progesterone. Or irregular cycles due to missed ovulation. So that can be quite common in situations like, for example, PCOS. So that could be any age. It's a very common characteristic of polycystic ovary syndrome. So again, this is common, this is explainable, but it's also supportable. And we don't just have to lie down and take it. How do we support progesterone and, well, ovulation? So the way that we support progesterone is through supporting ovulation, because that's how we make it. So I have six sort of pillars to support when it comes to supporting ovulation to therefore make progesterone. The first and most important one is supporting the nervous system, managing stress, whichever way we want to talk about this. But it's all about essentially telling our nervous system that we are safe, all is well. We don't need to, you know, this isn't, we don't need to be in this fight flight. It's supporting the brain, because the brain is the part of the body that is always sensing, looking for danger, looking for stressors that might be life-threatening. And unfortunately, the brain picks up on a whole host of things as life-threatening that are not life-threatening, like being too busy at work, not enjoying your job, not enjoying your life, having too much on, you know, running from here to there, not having any space for yourself, being worried about a meeting or a colleague or a conflict, having relation issues, always being late, stuck in traffic, you know, whatever it might be. Unfortunately, the brain picks up on these as life-threatening stressors. And that is one of the biggest blockers to ovulation. So chronic stress is one of the biggest blockers. When life feels overwhelming, ovulation just won't be prioritized, because your brain doesn't think, if it picks up on overwhelm and stress and busyness and late and, you know, all of these things, it doesn't think that you're in a safe environment, and therefore it won't prioritize or even allow, or, you know, send the signals down for ovulation to occur. And it isn't something you can logic your way out of. The nervous system needs to feel safe. So simple, it's like a somatic experience that it needs. Simple daily practices that can make a really big difference are things like gentle breathing. So breathing in through the count of through to a count of 4 seconds and out to a count of 6. So that's known as the 4-6 breathing, or something known as box breathing, where you breathe in for 4, hold for 4, out for 4, hold for 4, or also one known as 4-7-8. So you breathe in for 4, you hold for 7, and you breathe out for 8. The 4-6 breathing is just the easiest thing. And it's also known as resonance breathing. So it really helps to bring that feeling of safety to the brain and the nervous system. You could do that for 3 minutes at a time, 5 minutes at a time, 10 minutes at a time, 2 minutes at a time, you know, whatever you have. First thing in the morning, last thing at night. It's lovely to do when you're lying in bed and you're just trying to get yourself ready for sleep. I always find it sends me off. First thing in the morning can just be a really nice way to ground yourself if you're somebody who wakes up feeling quite stressed already, or anticipating the day ahead. You know, you're already feeling a little bit heightened. The 4-6 breathing just for 3 minutes on the end of your bed, put your feet down on the floor, feel your feet on the floor, hands on your lap, and just do some 4-6 breathing for 3 or 4 minutes. Time in nature, really helpful for sending that sense of safety to the brain. It's been shown in studies to reduce, to really improve mood, reduce anxiety, support energy levels. So any time in, you know, any sort of nature space that you can get into, but obviously you want to be mindful and not be listening to something, or, you know, you want to be taking in the sights that you see and the sounds that you can hear in that nature. Yoga, Qigong, Tai Chi, these all work in the same way. You've got the breath, you know, that mindful movement. Gratitude practices, whether you say things to yourself that you're grateful for, write them down, speak them out loud, whatever it might be, and make that a regular practice at least once a day to think of things that you're grateful for. I like to do it at night. I'll tell myself, you know, what were the 3 best things that happened today? And it's great, because it just, you know, you might either feeling not so great, and then suddenly you think of these three wonderful things that happened in your day that you just hadn't kind of remembered, so that can be really helpful. Yoga nidra, or also known as non-sleep deep rest, NSDR, it's a great lying down body scan meditation that has been shown. There's quite a lot of research behind body scan meditation, how impactful it is on that felt sense of safety for the brain and the body. Legs lying down with your legs up the wall. This is a great one to do if you work from home and you're sitting at a desk all day, taking regular breaks to just lay yourself down on the floor, shuffle your bum right up against a wall and just bring your legs up against the wall, even just for 5 minutes. That can be really restorative as well. Taking baths in Epsom salts as many times as you can in the week, or whether it's a bath or a foot bath, these things can be really supportive. But consistency matters more than duration. So we don't have to think, oh, yoga, yeah, I've been meaning to start that yoga class, I'll get to it one day. Rather than, you know, trying to get to this 60-minute class once a week that you're probably just never going to get around to, is there a way that you could practice yoga at home, even for 10 minutes at a time, 15 minutes? You know, have your own sort of yoga flow practice that you'll just learn that's 5 minutes long, and could you do roll out a mat at home and do it at home? That would be way more beneficial to be done like often throughout the week than just trying to do one class a week that, you know, you're finding too hard to get to. The same with the breathing as well. The next thing would be supporting your thyroid health, because thyroid health becomes increasingly more important as we move through perimenopause. So essentially we want to be monitoring, if you're going to hopefully get blood work to monitor your thyroid health, you're looking at TSH, free T4, free T3 and thyroid antibodies, of which there's two. I've done separate episodes on blood testing and thyroid, so I can link to those in the show notes. Thyroid imbalance can block ovulation and worsen, you know, therefore worsen symptoms of unopposed estrogen that we've talked about, and make your perimenopause experience just feel worse than it needs to. The next one would be to prevent or reverse what's known as insulin resistance. Again, I've done separate episodes on these. It's one of my biggest pillars within the membership that we work through. I work through this with all my clients as well, because blood sugar balance is foundational for hormone health and how you experience perimenopause. So essentially, to reverse or prevent insulin resistance, that means having adequate protein, healthy fats, fiber-rich carbohydrates, avoiding constant snacking. You know, maybe just trying to eat three square meals a day, maybe a fourth, a snack between lunch and dinner where needed to get that protein in. But ideally not eating any more than that throughout the day, as in frequency wise. Resistance training, so lifting weights, strength training, and a gentle overnight fast. So what I mean by a gentle overnight fast is a 12-hour overnight fast. So finishing dinner, let's say 8 o'clock, and then you would start your breakfast at 8 o'clock. So you've had a 12-hour fast. And I say that because some people don't kind of pay attention to the time that they're fasting overnight, and they may be, say, finishing dinner at 9 and then they're so hungry by 7 a.m. they eat. So that's only a 10-hour fast, but we really want to make that a minimum of 12 hours. Likewise, though, equally on the other side of that, we don't want to be fasting for too long. So we don't want to be finishing dinner at, say, 8 o'clock at night and then not having our breakfast till 10, 11 o'clock the next day. For most women moving through this phase of life, that is just far too long of a fast that it can become now a stressor. So the brain is picking up on this low blood sugar. It's now going, you know, 30, sort of 14, 15, 16 hours without food. And that can be this blood sugar low, which is a stressor. So the 12 hours is a lovely sweet spot. If you want to push it to 13, maybe maximum 14, that is usually okay for some women. But I think the sweet spot for most women, particularly, you know, if you're busy and you do have some stressors, I think the 12-hour mark is a nice sweet spot. The next one would be eat enough, eat well. You know, perimenopause is not the time for calorie restriction, for low calorie diets. It really isn't, or any sort of fasting, like I said, anything more than just the gentle overnight fast. Ovulation and that corpus luteum formation, they are energy demanding processes. And so we want to be aiming for sufficient, adequate calories every day. Quality protein with every meal, healthy fats with every meal, your complex, slow release carbohydrates, particularly with dinner. We don't want to have a low carb dinner because that can be quite a stress as well and start to impact sleep and overall ovulation. But it's like complex sources of carbohydrates, the ones that are fiber rich and break down slowly into glucose, and just watching our portion size and making sure that we've got plenty of nutrients like B vitamins, particularly B6, B12, folate, magnesium, zinc, iodine, selenium, vitamin D. Get your levels tested, make sure they're in the optimal range. CoQ10 and cholesterol. So, you know, we don't want to be low fat. Ideally, we want to be eating all foods, animal foods as well, and getting that real, you know, array of different minerals and nutrients and vitamins throughout the week. The fifth one is to be addressing any potential underlying inflammation, which becomes very much more common as we move through perimenopause. The body can sort of, our physiology can shift into more of a naturally inflammatory state. I mean, even just the act of having our period each month is a state of inflammation, you know, temporary state of inflammation. But as we move into perimenopause with that shift in estrogen and progesterone, chronic inflammation can become more inflammatory because we're losing anti-inflammatory effects of progesterone as it starts to decline, estrogen as it starts to become erratic, and it can start to increase cortisol, which is a pro-inflammatory hormone, and so on. So chronic inflammation can quietly in the background be blocking ovulation. So it could be as well, if you're somebody who has an autoimmune condition or is in the family, for example, rheumatoid arthritis, Hashimoto's, if you have gut issues, maybe imbalances in gut bacteria, you could maybe have parasitic infections that have been left unaddressed. You know, you may know or not know these things, but if you have gut issues, you know, if you have constant digestive issues that are plaguing you all the time, then that's a surefire sign that there is some sort of imbalance in the gut. And so that can be increasing inflammation. Food sensitivities, again, left unaddressed, insulin resistance. So again, basically that's blood sugar dysregulation, any potential infections or viruses. This is where that chronic inflammation can really be driven up as we go through perimenopause. And this part of it is really where deeper, personalized sort of one-to-one work can be incredibly helpful. So if you do feel like you want to explore one-to-one work with me, just drop me a line or head to my website and you can, or Instagram, and message me there. And finally, one of the most helpful ways as well to be supporting progesterone, particularly in your earlier phases of perimenopause, so late 30s, early 40s, even up to sort of mid to late 40s, but more so in the earlier 40s up to mid, Vitex. So this is also known as Chase Tree Agnus Castus. Vitex can basically support the brain to ovary communication that we've talked about, but changes in perimenopause. And that's what governs ovulation as to whether it actually happens, is the brain signaling down to the ovaries to tell it to release an egg, and then the ovary listening to the brain and actually doing what it's told and then forming the corpus luteum. So Vitex can support that brain to ovary communication, which I think is amazing. And I personally took Vitex for about 5 or 6 years myself. So it's best taken first thing in the morning from around day 6 of your cycle. So being day 6, you know, day 1 of your cycle being the first day of your period. So day 6 of your cycle, you start taking it until around day 1 of your period. So you take it around day 6, and then when you come on your period, which is your next cycle, day 1 of your next cycle, then you would take a short break for about 5 days and then start again day 6, if that makes sense. It's usually most helpful used for at least 3 months, but ideally for 6 months, while you're also addressing all the other foundations that I've already discussed. And it's also worth mentioning some other things in our days and our environment that can disrupt the body's ability to make progesterone. Whilst we're also looking at things you can do to support it, what can we think about maybe just being mindful of, because they may be impacting your body's ability to make it? So they would include alcohol. And again, it's not about getting rid of it particularly, unless you want to, like I did, but maybe looking to reduce it, or, you know, balance it out a little bit more. Too much caffeine, or particularly if you're relying on caffeine or having it first thing in the morning without eating anything, late nights, circadian disruption. So the body really doesn't like, that brain to ovary communication really doesn't like circadian rhythm disruption. It really does affect progesterone. So it likes to go to bed at the same time every night. It likes to wake up at the same time each morning. And it, you know, it just likes that 7 days a week. Blue light in the evening. So too much blue light from the TV, from screens, from your phone, from overhead lights in the house, those big bright lights, or, you know, if you're in an office or on a train, for example, that can really impact your ability to sleep well and restoratively, and therefore start to impact ovulation. Fasting, like I said already, when our stress system just isn't up for it, and there we are, wait until 10, 11 o'clock to eat breakfast, or, you know, just really trying to push that 16-hour fast every day is not usually helpful for supporting ovulation once we move through perimenopause and things are already quite sensitive. So these are small things, but they really do add up. So I hope there's one thing that you have taken from this episode. And if there is only, you know, one thing, I hope it's that you understand that your body isn't failing you. You know, if you're experiencing these symptoms as you're moving through perimenopause and you're feeling like things are changing, and why has this suddenly started to happen? I never used to have this. I always used to have, you know, regular periods, happy periods. I didn't have mood issues. You know, what is this? Your body isn't failing you. Your physiology isn't failing you. Perimenopause isn't a failure for any of us. It's a natural phase that we have to move through. But it is a request for us to do things differently and give ourselves better and different support. So progesterone is often the first place to start because, like I said, it's the first hormone to start falling earlier on in the phase. And I just hope that this episode's helped giving you some direction as to where you might be able to look, like where you could start supporting yourself. And if this episode's helped, I'd love to hear from you. I'd love if you left a review. That is the best way I can get this podcast to grow, or if you'd share it with someone who might need to hear it. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you next time. Bye-bye. If you enjoyed this episode, come and join me inside the Midlife Thrive membership. This is where I share my best resources, deeper education and coaching support to help you navigate perimenopause with clarity and confidence. Head to francescaliparotti.com/midlife-thrive-membership or check the link in the show notes, and I'll look forward to welcoming you into the community.